So tonight, I'm going to start with a story. This is a story about Mother Teresa. Some of you have heard it before. Apparently, a journalist was interviewing Mother Teresa, and he said, "I understand that you pray to God several hours every day." She just nodded. And then he said, "Well, what do you say to him?" And she said, "I don't say anything. I just listen." So the journalist said, "Well, what does he say?" And she said, "He just listens too." I love that story. It's my favorite Mother Teresa story. It's actually my only Mother Teresa story. And there are a couple of things I like about it. One of the things I like about it is that if one of my Christian friends asks me, "What's with this mindfulness meditation stuff?" You know, I can tell the usual. Well, I would naturally go into a long discourse on the 12 links of dependent origination. No, I don't do that. But you know, if you talk about, I find that if I talk about being with the truth of one's own experience or being in the present moment, you know, they'll nod, and, yeah, okay. But if I tell this story, they get it. They get it on a visceral level. So just a couple of comments on prayer, because she's talking about prayer. She's in a Christian tradition, so they use words that are a little bit different from the words that we use for our practice. Annie Lamott famously said that there are two kinds of prayer. There's the please, oh, please, oh, please, and the thank you, thank you, thank you. She also elaborated on that later on, but I really like that formulation, even though I think it's also a huge oversimplification. I once saw a presentation where a scholar, and I have a handout to prove this, I didn't bring it with me, that there are 11 kinds of prayer. But the one that I found most interesting was, and here's the $5 word, apophatic prayer, which basically means silent prayer, which I think of as being, the way it's I've heard it described, it's like meditation. It's what we do when we're doing a concentration practice. And this has been around for a while in traditions other than in Buddhism. There's a tradition called the Desert Fathers in Christianity who established monasteries in the deserts of what's now Egypt and Syria and Iraq back in the 3rd century AD. So they go way, way back. And their writings, they're describing states, for instance, that sound a whole lot to me like jhana states, the states of meditative absorption as they're described in Buddhism. So they were on to some of the same things that Buddhist practitioners have been aware of. And the Desert Fathers had a huge influence on some of the monastic traditions, and particularly later on Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross, who were also clearly practicing concentration meditation. So let's go to Buddhism. What I like about this story, the Mother Teresa story, is her just listening and her concept of God as just listening as well. And I think when I thought once about that story and thought about the Buddha as listener. And the Buddha, of course, we can extrapolate from his teachings and from what we know about him that he was a terrific listener. For one thing, he was really good at understanding his audience. He would go talk to Jains, or he'd go talk to Brahmins, or kings, or lay people, or generals. And he knew how to address their fundamental concerns in a very direct way. And part of that was that he was able to listen to them. I mean, he knew a lot. He was a smart guy. He was already a good teacher before he became enlightened. But he was really good at understanding the concerns of the people that he was with. And we could see that over and over again, the way he tailored what he said without changing the basics of what he said, but tailoring how he said it so that the people that he was talking to would really get it, would really hear it. The Buddha taught also that there were four kinds of question. Art talked about this a couple months ago. Four kinds of question are categorized by the appropriate kind of answer that you give to the question. And the first kind is the categorical answer. This is the question that's best answered with something like a yes or no, or go down two blocks and turn left, just where you state something as being true or untrue. And the Buddha himself didn't answer that many questions in this format. And when he did, they tended to be about just things like act skillfully or do things that are wholesome rather than unwholesome, or follow the Eightfold Path. The second kind of question, or the second kind of appropriate answer for a question, is the analytical answer. And the Buddha gave a lot of these. And this is the kind of question where he would give a brief discourse, often with one of his wonderful, colorful metaphors, to sort of illustrate his point and to sort of develop the idea, to sort of reveal an idea or a concept to his listeners. The third kind of question, as he taught it, was the question that was best answered with further questioning. Usually because the question was asked in such a way that it had to be reframed in order for there to be any kind of reasonable answer. So you get these wonderful things in the suttas, in the discourses, of him initiating or responding to someone and going through this dialogue. And you can see him sort of getting someone to come around to either realizing that their initial question was leading to a logical discontinuity, a self-contradiction, or that they would discover through the dialogue that there was simply a different way of approaching the question altogether. He did this kind a lot as well. He often mixed question methodologies as well. Like, he would often do an analytical answer, like give a long sort of reasoned discourse, and then he'd ask questions of his audience to see if they got it, which is a good thing because sometimes they didn't. The fourth kind of question, I find this particularly interesting, is the question where no answer at all is possible, because there's no answer that can lead to anything other than confusion. And he particularly liked to use this for ontological questions like, how did the universe start? Or where do I go when I die? Or questions like that, fundamental questions, assertions about reality. There's a famous story about, it's quite a short sutta, about the Buddha being visited by a wandering ascetic called Vajragatha. Vajragatha sits down and says, "So, I hear that you teach that there's no self." And the Buddha doesn't answer, doesn't say a thing. So Vajragatha says, so you teach that there is a self?" But it still doesn't answer. So Vajragatha rolls his eyes, gets up, and walks off. And Ananda, the Buddha's personal attendant, turns to the Buddha and says, "Why didn't you answer him?" And the Buddha said, "If I had said that there was no self, if I had said that there was a self, it would have sounded like eternalism. If I had said that there was no self, it would have sounded like nihilism. Either way, he would have been confused." Now, something that you may not have heard, I know many of you have heard this story, I've told it here before. Vajragatha actually did come back at some future date, according to other suttas, and the Buddha did give him a more reasoned answer, I think probably the Vajragatha asked a better question, but the Buddha gave him a much broader answer, and Vajragatha did become a follower of the Buddha. But I love this story just because it's very short and it's very punchy. So this is the kind of question that the Buddha felt deserved no answer at all, because there was simply no way that you could even reframe it in such a way as to make sense. So what's interesting about this, the Buddha teaching that there are four kinds of questions, Why would he do that? He's actually teaching his teaching methodology as well as teaching the discipline of the Eightfold Path and the other aspects of the practice that he's unfolding for his followers. So he's teaching his teaching methodology. In another sutta, he actually talks to his monks and tells them what kinds of questions to ask people, how to question people like Brahmins or Jains. So again, he's teaching his teaching methodology. Why would he do that? So Buddhism, of course, they didn't call it Buddhism at the time, but Buddhism was, in the Buddha's time, a very evangelical movement. The Buddha, early on, when there were about 60-odd members of his Sangha, of there were 60-odd followers, monks, who had taken robes with him, he actually sent them all out once. He gave a talk where he said, go from here, don't go in pairs, go singly, go in opposite directions, and tell people the truth of what you've discovered here. This is an evangelical method. And this is kind of a radical change. I'll get to that in a sec. And he checked up on this, and later on when the movement had really grown, I mean, it really became a huge movement in northern India. There's a story about how he ran into this young monk who was traveling to a place where the Buddha was staying. And he'd never seen the Buddha before, and so he didn't know that this guy he just met was the Buddha. So the Buddha didn't say anything. The Buddha said, oh, so this guy you're going to see, what does he say about? And then he gave him a topic. And then the monk gave a whole talk on this topic. And the Buddha said, that's right. That's exactly what the Buddha said. And I am the Buddha, so I approve of this message. So the point here, I think, that the sutta's making is that the Buddha was checking up on how well his message was being disseminated. So he was teaching the monks how to listen to people and how to see these four categories of questions. And so listening was a really essential part of his approach. Now, this was a big change for him. You know, if you remember the story of the Buddha, he had spent a couple of years being an ascetic, really an extreme ascetic, starving himself, exposing himself to heat and cold, almost dying from malnutrition. And then he finally left his five companions, who were also nuthatch ascetics, and he went and he took nourishment, and he discovered enlightenment, he discovered liberation. But when he first discovered his liberation, he just sat there in a state of unimaginable bliss. And he thought that it would be wonderful if other people could experience this. But there's no way he could teach it. It's just too difficult, too subtle, too inexpressible for him to possibly undertake teaching it. The story is that one of the gods came to him in one of his many forms and said, look, we can't do this. You have to. There are some people out there with but a little dust in their eyes. That's the phrase. I love that. But a little dust in their eyes. So the Buddha immediately thought of visiting two of his old teachers that he had studied with before he had become an ascetic. And then he found out that they had both died recently. And he was quite unhappy about it. He really respected and admired them, even though he had not stayed with them. And he really thought these two guys would get it. So then he thought, well, what about those five ascetic friends? We had lots of long discussions. Some of this I'm filling in myself, the story. But he figured that these five ascetic friends would also have a possibility to understand what he was going to try to teach. So he set out to walk from where he was enlightened to the deer park where his friends were staying, which was near modern-day Varanasi. And it probably took a day or two to get there. And we know that on the way, he was just radiant and glowing. And on the way, he met this guy, another wandering mendicant holy man. And the holy man saw the Buddha and said, wow, who are you? Who's your teacher? What does he teach? And the Buddha said something like, I have no teacher. I am the one who is fully awakened. and a couple of things like that. And so the other wanderer sort of, you know, said something like, oh yeah, that sounds great. Good job. And got out of there as fast as he could. So the Buddha realized that teaching was not going to be all that easy. He had to come up with some kind of way of articulating the truths that he had discovered. And he was pretty successful at this. When he finally found his five companions, he sat down and he talked about the middle way and the four noble truths, the fundamental basis of all of his future teachings. Everything he taught were elaborations on these. And yet even then, of these five ascetics, one immediately got it and became enlightened. But the other four didn't. And one of them, I think, according to tradition, never did. I think the others eventually became enlightened. They became his followers. But it wasn't easy. It wasn't simple. So you can see at first that he had no confidence at all, very little confidence that the truths that he had discovered could be taught at all to anyone. And then by not too long after, when he was up to about 60 members, he not only had confidence that this could be taught, but that other people could teach it, that the monks that he talked to could go out and teach it. This is a huge change. So the Buddha clearly thought that listening was really important, and it was an important part of his teaching, an important part of how he taught his monks to go out and expand his movements. And another aspect of that, I think, that makes perfect sense, but that we don't think about a lot, is listening is a crucial part of right speech. How can you possibly speak appropriately to somebody if you haven't heard what they've said? How can you respond appropriately if you haven't been listening? Now, we don't hear all that much about right listening as a part of right speech. And I think that's unfortunate, because right listening is a really important skill. And I think it's a vital part of right speech. I noticed that one of the things I like about Philip's Q&A sessions or other teachers' Q&A sessions, is it gives me a chance to watch how well they listen. And Philip is really good at listening. And there are other teachers at Spirit Rock who are really, really good at listening. And there are a few teachers who aren't. There's one teacher who I won't name who, when somebody asks a question, he'll give a brilliant answer to a different question. Slightly different, but still seriously different. And I know of one teacher who essentially comes up with some kind of boilerplate that has nothing to do with the question. There's some retreats I just don't go on these days. So at Marin Sangha, we're all about teaching the Dharma in daily life, about applying the teachings and our practice so that our lives change, so that we become different people, and that the people around us have an opportunity to become different people. So I wanted to talk tonight about something that I learned. Actually, this is part of a management training program that I went on many, many years ago. In a previous incarnation, I was a computer programmer, then I managed computer programmers. So I frequently get sent to these workshops where they tell you, don't be a jerk. You spend all day and get a free lunch being told not to be a jerk. And for some people, that was a huge revelation, by the way. So I'm not knocking it. But one of the things I learned that was hugely helpful was something, I don't remember what it was called, but I think of it as being radical listening. So here's a little bit of practicum for you, just some nuts and bolts stuff that you may be able to find useful. And in radical listening, there's a simple, well, it sounds simple, it's really not. And that is when somebody asks you a question, and this is not just any question like, what time is it? Mm-hmm. You're going to sound like a dope if you do this, and somebody just wants to know what time it is, or where the bathroom is, or something like that. But the trick is, repeat the question back to someone. This is really hugely helpful if somebody talks to you in a potentially combative situation, like a holiday and you've got relatives that you may have problems with. There's conflicts going on. You know, the brother-in-law comes over and says, "What were you thinking when you said, you know, these things that often can escalate into confrontations?" So the approach is just repeat the question. Not repeat it word for word, because that sounds dumb. Paraphrase it. So a couple things happen when you do this. First of all, this is, I found crucial, is you really may have misunderstood. I just did this a lot at work, and I've done it in other situations. I'm a musician, so band dialectics can get quite dicey sometimes. And I really was shocked at how often I just got it wrong. So this is very humbling to listen to paraphrase a question and find out that I've not gotten it right. To paraphrase a question, the second thing is, to in order to paraphrase a question in any kind of honest way, you have to have really listened to it. And you start to be aware of just how often you don't listen to a question. You're busy preparing your answer. Or you're saying, "Oh, this again." It's like you tend to be on automatic pilot, and you tend to let people behave in a way, or you expect people to behave in a way that they've behaved in the past, and you don't actually hear what got asked. So another thing that happens when you do this practice is it can really de-escalate tension. People just want to be heard most of the time. Somebody comes in and says, "It's really wrong that you did this and you allowed that." And if you say, "Oh, so you are telling me that this was a screw-up to have done that, and you believe that." It's amazing. I've had people walk into an office, and the fact that I just listened to them, and listened to them carefully enough to be able to paraphrase back to them, they'd say, "Oh, well, maybe I'm overstating my case." It was like the level of tension would just drop. It's amazing how much people just wanted to be heard. And the other thing is that people will start to work stuff out if they're heard. I would have people come in to confront me in my office to tell me how wrong a thing I had done. And then just by listening and repeating back to them, they would come up with a compromise or come up with really good arguments for arguments that I hadn't even thought of, about why I had done the right thing, or the good reasons for why I had done what I had done. It was just amazing watching things settle down into sort of a middle way. I had a guy working for me who had a job that involved a lot of different responsibilities and a lot of different clientels. He had to do stuff for a lot of different people. Very stressful job, and he was very, very good at it. But about once a week, he would come into my office and say, "Bill, what am I going to do? I've got all this stuff, and I have no idea how to do it." So I'd say, "Okay, well, what are you working on?" And he'd go to the whiteboard and write stuff down. And say, "Yeah, well, what do you think of that?" And so I'd just ask him a few questions or repeat a few things that he had said, and he would work it all out himself. I mean, he knew how to solve his own problems. Once he worked out a list, he'd work out the priorities and what could be put off and who to tell to go screw themselves and stuff like that. And so it was amazing. All I had to do was listen, and he would work out all these problems by himself without almost any intervention from me. It was great, because when I used this listening technique, people thought I was a genius. All I would do is sit there, paraphrase the questions, and nod like, you know, one of those bobblehead dummies. So let me go back to Mother Teresa for a minute. When Mother Teresa said that she was just listening, I think she was talking more than just about ear events. And I think that the meditation, the guided meditation we did, was a little bit about listening at all sense gates. And I really like the idea of listening, because listening is a little different when you think about it. Listening is different from hearing. Because listening, there's something active and yet broad and open and receptive about it. Whereas hearing is just sort of like, okay, I hear you, or I just heard a car. To me, there's a somewhat more passive connotation to the word hearing. Whereas listening is like an active reception, the quality of active reception. And I like to think of insight meditation as being listening at all the sense gates, trying to open and be receptive and accepting, not necessarily approving. We often mix that up. We think that to accept something means that we've got to approve of it, and that's not true. It might be painful what you're receiving or unpleasant. Accepting just means acknowledging that that's what's happening. So that open receptivity, accepting receptivity, is like listening at all of the sense gates. And I really like that form of meditation of just noticing what's going on without getting stuck to any particular thing. And when you do get stuck, just notice that. Got stuck. Had to let go. There's a great Zen story that I know a number of you have heard. The story is that in Japan, medieval Japan, an aristocrat had heard that the abbot of the local Zen monastery was quite a wise man and had some very interesting teachings. Now, this aristocrat was himself an educated man, knew a lot, considered himself a bit of a philosopher, and a patron of the arts. So he invited the abbot to come and visit him, but found the abbot doesn't leave the monastery, so he actually went and visited the monastery. And he's ushered into this rather austere room. And the abbot of the monastery serves in this, the tea ritual, he serves tea. So the aristocrat's sitting there with his tea. He says, "So, I hear that you have some very interesting teachers, some very interesting teachings. Please tell me all about it. Please tell me what you know." So the abbot wordlessly reached for the tea kettle and said, "Would you like more tea?" And the aristocrat sort of gave a blank look because there was plenty of tea in his cup. And the abbot just started pouring tea in the cup and it overflowed the cup all over the table. And the aristocrat finally said, Stop. You're wasting all that tea." So the abbot put down the teapot and he said, "It is just so. If you want tea in the cup has to be empty. If the cup is full, there's no place for the tea to go." So the story obviously is about if you're full of yourself, if you know a whole bunch of stuff, there's no place to learn anything new. There's a Zen saying, in the mind of a child, there are a large number of possibilities. In the mind of the expert, there are very few. Now, I'm not putting down expertise. It's very useful. But even an expert should try to cultivate a quality of being able to perceive the new, to be surprised. So I really like the idea of cultivating this quality of an empty cup, or at least a partly full cup. I tend to be a very full cup. I'm opinionated, I know a bunch of stuff, I'm in the habit of being right. So for me, this is a really good practice of trying to cultivate at least a not so full cup capability, capacity. And we probably all know people who are full cups. I have a friend who is just a wonderful person, talented, funny, very successful, loved by many, respected by her peers. And yet, if you try to tell her something or teach her something new, it's just like she nods and smiles. Mm-hmm. You loan her a book, it goes unread. She's a full cup. Wonderful person, but she's a full cup. And Barbara and I joke about a few people we know who are full cups. And this is a great counterexample. Trying to cultivate a little bit of capacity for surprise, or cultivating what in Zen is called don't know mind. I mentioned the Desert Fathers earlier, who did these meditation practices in the desert. Within the Christian tradition, one of the Desert Fathers, I've read some excerpts from their writings, one of the Desert Fathers said, and this is just an example of the kind of language they use, to be filled with God, you must be empty of yourself. Now, I'm a little uncomfortable with the G word. Some of you are, some of you may not be. But to be filled with whatever is out there to fill one, you have to find a little bit of emptiness of self. And this sounds very Buddhist, and it sounds very much like emptiness meditation practices. That the Desert Fathers discovered a lot of the same things that Buddhists have discovered. The importance of don't-know mind, of cultivating the don't-know mind, cultivating a capacity for surprise, for novelty, for change. So I thought this talk was going to go for an hour. I timed it out that way. I guess I must talk faster when I get up here. So let me throw it open to any questions or comments. Anyone? Else we get to go home early. Linda?
I have this thing with don't know mind. There are times when I am just so clear on what don't know mind is. And then I'll read something or discuss it with another member of Sangha, and I'm like, when I try to articulate it, it disappears.
Hold on a sec. Let's give you a mic.
I didn't hear you.
I have this problem with don't know mind where I will, maybe in talking with somebody else or on my own thinking, and I'll get to what I think is a really clear concept of what don't know mind is. And then when I go to discuss it with somebody or we're in our Sutta study group, and I was, all of a sudden that like just disappears and I'm back at like, I don't know what don't know mind is. It's so...
I know exactly what don't know mind is all about. I completely understand it.
Saying the wrong thing.
No.
Not self.
Oh, not self.
Not self.
I see.
Sorry. I misspoke myself. That it will be very clear.
Not self is a tough one. What I like to look at not self as is that it's an experience that I can have on retreat. I have to have been meditating for a while before it comes up. Thanissaro Bhikkhu has a really interesting way of looking at not-self. His feeling is that rather than the Buddha, when people ask the Buddha point blank, is there a self or is there not a self, he would refuse to answer. And yet he often talked about a self as if there was one, or he would talk about a self as if there wasn't one. So come on, which is it? Can't you make up your mind? So Thanissaro Bhikkhu believes that what the Buddha was really trying to point to was that sometimes it's skillful to behave as if there is a self. As Ajahn Amaro once said, you may see yourself as being a part of the unfolding process of the universe, but if a cop pulls you over when you're driving, that's not a very good way to respond when he says, ask for identification. It's much better to give him your driver's license. So that's a situation where it's much more useful to behave as if there is a self.
Yes. sometimes I do really see that there's no one solid Linda from moment to moment to moment that is unchanging. And so that's when I start to think, well, maybe I've got a little bit of a handle on what mm-hmm. this not self is. On a good day.
Yeah, on a good day. Well, again, I think it's a really difficult concept, and I really like seeing the self as a verb instead mm-hmm. of a noun. Self mm-hmm. is not something that we are; it's something that we do. We build up a sense of self, and we can do it in a very unwholesome way. We get attached to our opinions. We get what we call egotistical. There's all kinds of behaviors we can get into when we create this sense of self when it's not necessary. If we're pulled over by a cop, great, but there are lots of times when we really get attached to ideas when it's really not helping us. So I like the idea of self as a verb, and to just observe the way in which we're selfing, and not try to fix it necessarily, because that's really hard. Just observe the way we construct a sense of self.
Will you remind me, you just reminded me of Donald Rothberg, when he was talking about the thick and the thin, and I could see where, you know, when I'm identifying with my ideas and my concepts and stuff, I can see that self being very thick. And when I'm not so much there, that it thins down, so there's not really a thought self, but there's less self.
Well, you're noticing. That's great. And that's, this is like, you know, mindfulness at work. When you start to notice stuff like that about where the self is thick and where it's thin, that's really good.
It's still a thin self. It's not a no self.
It's not a no self. It's not, it can be scary, by the way, when the self.
Correct. And I think that's a big difference.
Yes, there is.
A big difference. It looks like there's a no self. I kept looking around for the no self.
Well,
it's not
so. Some people like to use the phrase that it's impersonal, that it's not personal, rather than self or no self or not self. But you see, we get into all kinds of dicey linguistic issues too.
Yeah, I sometimes think we just don't even have the language for it. That's why I think I can sometimes have a fairly clear, I would say, concept that's feeling sense of it, but then to try to discuss it with somebody else is where it falls apart, because it's more of a, like I say, it's a verb, it's a sense, it's not a solid.
Yeah, concept. And I found on a long retreat, once or twice, I had a sense of self fall away, and I found it kind of scary. My personality really didn't want to get left behind. You know, as Ajahn Sumedho says, the personality doesn't become enlightened. But it really doesn't like to be left alone either. Anybody? Arlette?
I really like that concept of the technique, actually, of answering a question by repeating, or repeating, not answering a question, but repeating the question back for a number of reasons. One of which is that I have a family member who answers, infuriates me by answering a question with another question. I like more question. I like the sense of, I think that people need, often when they ask a question, they need to feel more than just heard, but validated. And this is one reason, is that this is a way of validating someone without actually having to, you know, where you may not agree with them, you may not want to actually validate, but at least they feel validated and feel heard. And it doesn't slam doors, it keeps doors open.
Very much.
Another thing is that I'm a person, what Philip calls a slow thinker. I'm very thoughtful, but I don't do it that quickly when it comes to important things. So this buys time to think about that, and and to give and to avoid wrong speech. You know, to practice right speech if you have more time to do that, if you're a person who needs more time. And and I don't know if I remember the other part of that, but it had to do with unlearning. This is kind of what you're talking about with the cup being full, is that when you do that, when you repeat the question, and it just gives you more time and more capacity to kind of push aside your prepackaged answers and your pile of, stuff that is information, but that's real, you know, tangible and material that may be getting in the way of clear thinking that involves other parts of you than just the small part of our brain that we normally think and act with.
Yeah, I think repeating a question to someone means that you have to listen carefully. And it also requires a certain kind of honesty. I didn't bring this up earlier, but you've got to be careful not only not to just repeat it verbatim, but also not to do the sort of response like, "You think what?" You know, you can't paraphrase it in a voice dripping with contempt. This is not a good time for sarcasm. So it's a discipline because you really find yourself questioning yourself on how honest you are as a listener, how good a listener you are. And if you do this on a regular basis, you start finding yourself being a better listener for it.
And it also makes you more of peers. Because, I'm repeating your question.
Yes, right.
Oh, it's like, let's explore this together.
Right, right. So it's particularly good for a boss, but I think it's good for anybody, for family situations. There was somebody else.
Yeah, I just had a comment. I had piggyback on what Arlette was saying. If I'm talking to somebody and I'm tempted to give them advice, I try to just keep on repeating back what I think they might be trying to communicate. Mm. And it works a lot better than giving advice for me.
Mary? Oh, sorry. You've got the mic.
I was going to say something about what Arlette said, too, and that was that I think it was Viktor Frankl that said between stimulus and response, there's a space of time, and meditation helps you be more responsive and less reactive. And I always remember that when I try to remember that. And I was going to say something about what Linda said, too, and a poem I heard recently about we're all on the road to enlightenment, but we keep stopping at mean-spirited roadhouses. And I love that because I think, for me at least, it's when I get caught up in my sense of self that I'm more likely to be caught up in a mean-spirited roadhouse, and when I can be free of that, then I'm more likely to not be stopping at a mean-spirited roadhouse.
Right.
One other thing I wanted to say about this listening to people, allowing people to be heard, is a movie was shown here not too long ago. And I forget, what's the name of the movie?
Welcome.
And it was about a group of returned veterans who are working with issues like post-traumatic stress disorder. And there was one woman who was clearly very deeply upset. And at one point, she just sort of unleashed on the whole group. But what she said is, don't try to fix me. Don't try to tell me I'm wrong. Just hear me. And most people just want to be heard. And we always want to fix them or shut them up or get away from them or get them to go away or something. We have our own agenda. How often do we actually just hear somebody? So who had the mic next? Mary?
I work for a school district, and one of the things they have, which I think has been great, and it seems very Buddhist, but they have for as a socio-emotional education for the students, is they have a toolbox. And one of the things they talk about is the listening tool. And we talk about that because I have a little sniper in one of the groups I work with. And we talk about it. Listening with your head and listening with your heart. And I think that's really important, is not just to hear what they're saying, but can you have your heart be open? Can you actually try, grok or feel what's being said? And I actually went to a workshop somewhat of years about that, paraphrasing. But it really is, I think it's really important, is to have your heart open when you're listening. And what I realize is sometimes when I'm, like, by the Teresa show, just listening, I need to remember that it's not just watching what's coming up, but to do it with an open heart, because some of the stuff that comes up is really crap. And I have to be with that, with an open heart as well. But I think it's a great tool. Listen with your head, listen with your heart.
Right. And the thing about paraphrasing is sometimes it's really hard to have an open heart when you're in a situation where there's latent hostility. But at least this moves you in a good direction.
I was asking you, is what you're going to say going to make the situation better or worse?
Yeah, it gives you a little bit of time to avoid screwing things up worse than they already were. Shaya, there's a microphone coming at you.
Thinking about what Linda, what Linda said about self and not self. And on the retreat somewhere, I can't remember which one or where, but there was an exercise where two people talked to each other. And it was one of these exercises where you ask the question. And the question is, tell me who you are. And then the other person answers. And the question is repeated for 10 or 15 minutes at a time. And so you can go through all the, well, to me it was a very opening kind of thing where after a while I sort of, there was no place I could hang my hat that I could say, you know, well, this is really who I am, and it sort of like leaves you with an open space that, I mean, what I came to, which I still remember, is that the only thing I could hang my hat on was awareness. That, you know, awareness could be a place where it would exist. It wasn't who I was, but it was some aspect that could be there. But that was just my experience.
I've done that experience. That exercise too. It's quite amazing what it does. There's an article, by the way, in a recent New Yorker. The article is about psilocybin, but it talks about that there's a part of the brain that mediates between our reptile and mammalian brains and our cortex. And we have this that's sort of developed evolutionarily. It's not entirely perfect, but it provides us with a strong sense of self. And there are exercises that we can do, like meditation, that tend to disrupt that strong sense of self, which is why no self can become a very real experience in a meditation or a retreat situation, or if we take psilocybin. So I'm a little old for that. But it's very interesting that also that this exercise of just asking these repeated questions, who are you, or I've heard other variants on it as well. In fact, I think it's even a little dangerous. It can get scary because you can get quite disoriented. I've seen people stand up from that looking quite drunk. But it is very interesting because it will really dislocate your sense of self. Deborah?
So thank you, Mary, for that. I like the end goal of keeping your heart open. That's really helpful. And Linda and I have had a couple of conversations lately on self and no self. What helps me is the word abiding, that there's no abiding self, there's no permanent self. And we are doing the sutta study, and I've been practicing mindfulness of posture and moving from one posture to the next posture. So that's sort of a physical level of keeping me aware of the constant changing. And in terms of asking questions, I was having a conversation recently, several with a friend who's freaking out about both buying a new car and moving. And what I found was really helpful was asking her what her ultimate goals were. And I think that helped her think through how does she get to peace, what's easy and peaceful. So in addition to what you guys have been saying, which I think is really helpful, I have found that to be really helpful, is where do you want to be about this? Do you want to be in alignment with your values or, you know, whatever is appropriate for the situation. So the word abiding in that technique, I just wanted to share those. Thanks.
One more?